Hello and welcome to SSI Live. You've long known the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College as the go-to location for issues related to national security and military strategy with an emphasis on geostrategic analysis. SSI conducts strategic research and analysis to support the U.S. Army War College curricula, assist and inform Army, DoD, and U.S. government leadership, and serve as a bridge to the wider strategic community. Now we're bringing you access to SSI analyses, scholars, and guests through this, the SSI Live podcast series. Thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to this edition of SSI Live. My name is John Denny, and I'm a research professor of National Security Studies here at the Strategic Studies Institute. It's Wednesday, August 21st, 2024. And we're coming back from a summer break, if you will. And today I'm joined by my SSI colleagues, Dr. Mike Lynch and Major Brennan Devereaux. Mike is a research historian and associate professor of national security affairs at SSI. And Brennan is an Army strategist and a research analyst at SSI, focusing on military adaptation and emerging technology. Together, Mike and Brennan have just published an article in the Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs entitled Land Power, Homeland Defense, and Defending Forward in U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. And I've asked them to talk to us today about their article. Mike, Brennan, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us.
Now, guys, when most Americans think about homeland defense, I think they typically think about or have in their minds, you know, a picture of the contiguous 48 states and missile defense assets protecting us from incoming missiles of some kind. Maybe they lump in Hawaii and Alaska too, but this really doesn't begin to capture the extent of U.S. territory that has to be defended, does it?
That's right, John. As we say, America's defense, or America's day, starts in Guam. Guam is, of course, a U.S. territory. One of the ones we need to pay attention to, as well as American Samoa. Those are U.S. citizens that are under the defense umbrella. So we have to consider them as part of the homeland too. There are other islands that we're also involved with the defense of in the Pacific as well.
And I think it's important that it's a framework shift as the conversation. So it's not we're not arguing that there's new islands or new territories we need to account for. But that simple understanding that you mentioned, that if I start with my framework that the United States is the 48 states or including Alaska and Hawaii, that's going to shape how I prioritize assets, how I think about defense, and really how I understand the threat. And as we look at bigger picture of prioritization and funding, that is really limited in what we need to do to continue to fight for relative advantage over our adversaries.
Well, Brendan, you mentioned threat. So let's back up just a minute and tell us about the nature of that threat. What do you make of the challenges confronting the U.S. homeland today? And maybe you can put this in some historical context for us, especially you, Mike, as a research historian. You know, for example, 20 years ago, it was probably fair to say that our primary homeland security threat was terrorism, right? Either emanating from abroad or inspired abroad and then coming from within. How has that perception evolved today? Where do we see the threats to these, this broader conceptualization of our homeland?
Right. I think those threats are still extant in the continental United States, but in the region that we're discussing, the growing threat is influence from the People's Republic of China, the PRC. That influence extends from political, commercial, and military throughout the region. To give a historical-based example, one of our most important facilities in the Pacific is Kwajalein Atoll, where our Pacific missile test range lies.
So if I could add to the threat, there's a shift not only in what the threat is, but I think it's important to identify a shift in who can act. So for the longest time, there was the Soviet Union threat, right? Maybe we'll be invaded. And we even have a fun little anecdote at the beginning of the article that talks about like a Red Dawn type scenario that people are quick to paint, you know, a Russian invasion into Montana or something. But a missile threat from Russia, China, or a, you know, an actual military attack has been an existing threat for a long time. But really, we have we generally have that deterred, mutual assured destruction with nuclear weapons. Things like that have made it so it's hard for a nation like that to act. And terrorism became the rise on, a new agent that could act. The problem now is technology that allows for, a cyber attack, just simply information operations that stoke the fires of civil unrest, allow those other great power adversaries, again, to act instead of just threaten. And that really complicates our actions on how we can stop them versus just a buildup of forces to match their buildup of forces.
And John, if I could add to that, there are a couple of examples of island chains or island nations that a lot of Americans may not have heard of. We can even assume that most people know that Guam and American Samoa are part of the United States. But when we talk about Kiribati and the Solomon Islands, those are not typically familiar terms to a lot of people. So that when we say that the Chinese have made great investments in both of those, it doesn't really ring any bells for Americans. When we say that those two nations have recently switched their allegiance from Taiwan to the PRC, you might say, who cares? But the capital of the Solomon Islands is an island called Guadalcanal. And the capital of Kiribati is an island called Tarawa. And those names sound very loud bells in American military history. We spent lots of blood and treasure taking those islands during World War II, and now they're under the influence of another great power.
Let me just ask you one more question about the nature of the threat now. I mean, of course, we know from our national security strategies, our defense strategies over the last several years, extending back not only through this administration, but the previous one, that we in the U.S. now view China as the pacing threat, right? And if we see China as the pacing threat, Russia as the acute threat, this is the phrasing typically used today, we might quibble with that, but let's take those assumptions as valid. When we think about places as far away as Guam, or Kiribati, for example, the islands you've been speaking of, we have kind of a time distance challenge here, don't we, in terms of dealing with or responding to that threat. I imagine that's part of this reconceptualization as well, not merely that we've got these extended parts of our homeland well beyond the 50 states, but that the nature of where those places are makes this an even more complex problem to get our arms around. Is that right?
That's true, John. And we've actually developed a new verbal shorthand in the military for that region called West of the International Dateline, or West of the IDL. So much in the way we used to say the inner German border or the IGB in Europe 30 years ago, West of the IDL has become a marker. And, a lot of people who have not been across the Pacific don't know how big it is. You could put three continental United States between the West Coast and Asia. It's vast, and puts a lot of its other challenges in as well.
And I think to your point, there's something inherently strategic about being able to make that distance smaller. And something as simple as access, spacing, overflight, things we talk about that influence really gets you. We would much rather be able to have some stops along the way, have some resources along the way, facilities for repairing ships, something as simple as that, that's earned through relationships. It's earned through support versus earned through a violent recapture of an island, all back to our World War II examples in the article. That's not the path that leads to victory.
Brendan, that's a great segue to what I want to talk about next or ask you about next. Okay, so we know the threat picture has evolved, right, as you've described for us, and we've got to maintain this far broader conceptualization of what the homeland is. Tell us now about some of the ways the Army and the other services are promoting defense and deterrence, given this evolved threat environment, given these vast expanses, et cetera, in the Indo-Pacific region.
I'll start from the national level and work down. The United States, within the last 2 years, has now placed embassies in the Solomon Islands and in Kiribati. We previously had no embassy in Kiribati, and we had an embassy in Solomon Islands, but not since 1993. So we've reestablished our diplomatic presence there. And that means a lot to nations. It says something when the U.S. puts an ambassador there, and it signals the importance of that nation. It also typically opens that government up to allowing partnership with militaries. And we're doing that through Operation Pacific Pathways, which is U.S. Indo-Pacific Command's series of exercises with our allies and partners in the Pacific.
I think if I add to, there's two things that I think really are kind of shifting how we're approaching the problem. The first is simply acknowledging the problem. So you can find articles if you work in the Homeland Defense business, you have heard them yell to the wind that the homeland is no longer a sanctuary, right? This has become the mantra, and we've seen a shift in national security documents acknowledging the priority of the homeland. And I think what we're seeing is a shift in understanding that basic foundations for how we operate are threatened, like contested logistics. We might not be able to just take something from America to anywhere in the world and everyone just be okay that we're doing a free move. Acknowledging that and training to support that, I think, is a big shift. And I had a chance to work at Army North before coming up to the War College. And that was one of the things we emphasized. If we were doing an exercise at Army North, it was in support of, whether they were on board or not, we knew that it was in support of another region of the world. If we're doing something to support the movement of equipment to the East Coast, it's to support somewhere in the European command. Same thing with the West Coast. It's to support the fact that we can push through, create redundancies for those contested logistics and show our adversaries very publicly that, we can do this. We have built-in redundancies. We're not as vulnerable as you might think we are.
Tell me more about the Army's footprint or the military's footprint in the Indo-Pacific, specifically that presence. Mike, you mentioned, the State Department expanding its diplomatic presence in theater. In the region I tend to focus on, Europe, most European allies, they just want to see American boots on the ground, right? Even if they're not really doing anything particularly of a great impact, it's the presence they're after, right? Because they believe that has a reassuring effect for their own population and a deterring effect against the Russians. So how's the Army? Tell us about how the Army is maintaining, modifying, or adding to its presence in this region.
John, I think our security cooperation mission is probably the most important mission that we have, really. And that has several facets. First of all, we've had special forces stationed in the region for decades, and they operate with partner and allied nations special forces. But well beyond that, for about 30 years, we've had the state partnership program in which National Guards from different states are partnered with nations in the region. I think there are 14 of them now, and they are partnered with states and territories. Guam is partnered with somebody, and those relationships go on year on year. The same people coming back to the same locations, training with U.S. units in the U.S. and U.S. units training in that nation. U.S. Army Pacific has also started within the last couple of years the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, the JPMRC, which is a series of exportable exercises, and they recently completed one in the Philippines. They plan to do three per year, one in Hawaii, one in Alaska, and one west of the IDL. That is a great way for allies and partners to work with U.S. forces in a U.S. training environment, which provides feedback and opposing forces and all of the right instrumentation and telemetry to give those units feedback. At the same time, it's also helping those units understand U.S. doctrine and equipment and making them more able partners with us. And then the last component is the Security Force Assistance Brigade. The 5th SFAB is based in Washington State, but it deploys throughout the region to conduct training for units in the area. And what all that leads up to is a persistent presence. As you mentioned, it's boots on the ground, but it can't be boots on the ground for 2 weeks and then they go away for a year. It's the persistent presence is more important than periodic presence.
How's China reacted to all of this? What do we see Beijing up to across the region in response to this uptick in the operational tempo of U.S. forces? Or would you characterize our efforts as more a reaction to what China's been doing? Are we reacting to some of the same things that they've been doing in these lanes or these areas?
I'll jump on that one. And I think this is a chicken and the egg kind of question. I would love to say both and not or, as I learned in school. There is an uptick. There's an uptick from the U.S. There's an uptick from China. But I think we've been seeing a game between the two countries for a while, a fight for influence, a fight for, regional superiority. And I think it's fought in two real realms. And we've seen China, going back to the uptick, we've seen China invest heavily first in their military capabilities. So recently, and things that we should be concerned about, a increase in nuclear warheads, the development of, other nuclear sites, things that could keep the U.S. at bay, the counter type of weapons, and increased spending on their Navy, their missile defense forces, and things along those lines. And that's something we'll obviously continue to watch. And part of that is just China modernizing and developing. At the same time, there's a push for influence. So China, not the same approach the U.S. takes, but is fighting for that influence in the region, right? And they're doing that through economic investments. They're doing that from some gunboat diplomacy as they're taking over some waters and pressuring nations into things, and some really uncomfortable dealings that are granting them potential access to ports, access to airfields. And I think that's really one of the battles that we need to be watching for as we continue to gain access is China's reaction on pushing into those same nations for access. And we're in front when it comes to, say, basing. As you see, China has limited bases outside of China. Particularly the one that comes to mind is in Camp Lemon near Djibouti, that area, the Bab el-Mandeb. So they still have a presence, but they don't have the same kind of support to the region. So I think that's their big push now is both modernizing the force and then continuing to fight for access, even if it's simply port access or flyover rights.
And if I could add to that, just to give an example, in TerraWise, we've already mentioned the Chinese are building a deep water port. And as we come in with soldiers and partnership that sort of military influence, they come in with the commercial influence and build things or convince the locals that they will build things that will benefit them, but also have military application for the Chinese.
My final question for you both is, what would you recommend looking forward? What would you tell military leaders at U.S. Army Pacific or at Indo-PACOM or both on what they should change, what they ought to do differently, what they should do more of, in terms of trying to achieve a more effective, more efficient forward defense of this broadened conceptualization of our homeland?
I think it starts even a little above combatant commander. I think we have to have adequate forces in the region. The Indo-Pacific is a joint command, and we will need all legs of the joint force to fight there. But the fact is the Army is very thin on the ground and the Army has a lot of responsibilities there. So I think that the national authority needs to put the resources forward that are necessary in terms of force structure and equipment and infrastructure. Beyond that, I then think that the Indo-PACOM commanders and U.S. Army Pacific are doing what they need to do. They need to just continue that. And the only addition I would make is that, as General Charlie Flynn, the commander of U.S. Army Pacific, says, the geometry of geography in the Pacific is pretty significant. And that is a long supply line from wherever you go. So I would make sure that we have redundant stockages of supplies and equipment scattered throughout the Pacific.
If I can add to that, I think one thing they could do, and I'm not one to tell a combatant command to do anything different. Instead, mm-hmm. I think they need to amplify what they are doing and highlight the narrative. So the very public narrative is, you know, China is the pacing threat. China is dangerous. We have to account for China. And I think that we have embraced that. We've accepted that. And I think that the next narrative we really need to make sure we're supporting and pushing out there is these territories, these islands are the homeland. We have to defend them. We have to support them. And I would love to see Indo-PACOM, USERPAC take on more of a homeland defense kind of, not necessarily model, but, you know, mantra that, you know, this isn't just preparing for war with China. This is defending the United States forward. And I think that they do that internal in their organization. I think they do that external to the partners in the region and to, you know, those territories specifically. And I think they do that up, back to Dr. Lynch's point, they take that up to the national authority. You know, that's part of, you know, the testimony to Congress is this is the homeland forward and we are the defending element. We're there to support.
And if I could just add one thing to that, I think when I talked about persistent presence, we had persistent presence in Europe throughout the Cold War and on the Korean Peninsula for much of it. But in the last 20 or 30 years, we've retrenched back to largely a CONUS-based military. And I would say that if we were to start stationing forward, permanent stationing forward, that would send messages not only to the PRC, but to our partners and allies. And when I say permanently stationed forward, I would, in places where it's appropriate, I'd put families there as well. Because then when you put families there, it really does become part of the homeland. And if I could just give one quick example of where we're caught between a rock and a hard place is Palau. We put one of our cutting edge radars there, the mobile over the horizon radar, and it's critical for fleet operations. But we'd also like to put Patriot in there to guard it. But the Palauans don't want Patriot because they're afraid that it would draw the Chinese. Now, this is a pro-Chinese government in Palau at the moment. They accept the radar, but they don't accept the Patriot. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place there.
I think there is, though, a balancing act there, right? So there is the escalation. As I went back to the chicken and the egg, China is going to respond to U.S. action. So there's appropriate places to add troops, appropriate places maybe to add families. At the same time, you know, we have to avoid escalation. And I think within the dealings to do that and to work that out is really one through the influence fight. To your point, if the government is very much, you know, pro-US and is seeing the challenge the way we're seeing it, we're sharing a lens that we're viewing the problem, it's going to be a lot easier to try to shape a solution versus trying to battle our way in a la the Chinese approach.
Well, gentlemen, it's a fantastic article. I am especially appreciative of the historical linkages you've got peppered throughout the piece. As a person who studied history before I got my degree in political science, I appreciate that very much. Listeners, you can now find their insightful article entitled, again, Land Power, Homeland Defense, and Defending Forward in U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, online now at the website of the Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs. And I'll be sure to include a link to that article in the show notes. You can download that for free today. Dr. Mike Lynch and Major Brennan Devereaux, thank you very much for joining me today at SSI Live.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
You can now find SSI Live on TuneIn Radio and on popular podcast directories like Stitcher and at the iTunes Store. If you have any comments on our podcasts, thoughts on what you'd like to see addressed, or a response to something you heard here at SSI Live, please go to our website. That's ssi.armywarcollege.edu. Find me, John Denny, in the staff directory, and send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. For the SSI Live podcast series, I'm John Denny. Thanks for listening.